Hey there, podcast listener. This is Meg Malone, VPR's digital producer, and I am just letting you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, keeping it to the point. So let's get started.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. As we've just learned from Congressman Peter Welch, a number of House committees are quite busy with the impeachment process, calling witnesses, getting ready to issue subpoenas to members of the Trump administration. How does the impeachment process work, and does past history act as a guide to what we can expect to happen if the House votes out articles of impeachment in the coming weeks? Well, we've got two guests with us to look at the logistics and the politics of impeachment. Ken Rudin is with us. He's a former political director at NPR and now the editor of the podcast Political Junkie. And Ted Cohn, who is the chairman of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. Ken and Ted, great to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Bob. It's Bob, Ted, Ken, and Alice.
Ken, let's just walk through briefly the impeachment process. As we know now, several House committees are gathering evidence, gathering testimony. What happens next? Is there going to be an effort by the Judiciary Committee to look at this, or what's going to happen?
Well, yes, the Judiciary Committee is among those five or six committees put together by Nancy Pelosi. Well, actually, the standing committees assigned by Nancy Pelosi to investigate, and that includes the House Intelligence Committee as well, and Oversight Committee and things like that. And they will all get their information together, ostensibly for the argument to see if there's impeachment charges are warranted against President Trump. Now, as we saw with Bill Clinton's impeachment in 98 and Richard Nixon's about to be impeached in 1974, it then goes to the House Judiciary Committee, which would vote on individual articles of impeachment, say, for example, obstruction of justice.
So let's say House Judiciary votes out one or two articles of impeachment, as happened in 1998. It then goes to the House floor. Do we have counter arguments on the floor?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as we saw, remember, during the impeachment inquiry, actually the impeachment trial. Now, let me start again. The impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton on the full House floor in 1998. Remember, it never reached the House floor in 1974 because Richard Nixon resigned before that process went forward. But with Bill Clinton, you'll have the arguments made by the leaders of the House Judiciary Committee. With Bill Clinton, it was Henry Hyde of Illinois, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Back in 74, it was Peter Rodino of New Jersey, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee back then. And then you'll have the arguments on the other side. So it would be basically a full debate before the full House votes.
Now, Ted, let's say the House votes an article or two or three of impeachment, sends them over to the Senate. The Senate basically has a trial on these charges?
That's what the Constitution says, that it's up to the Senate to try under the articles of impeachment. But it's really up to the Senate itself to kind of write the rules for what that trial looks like. Senator Byrd, before the Clinton trial, tried to dismiss the articles of impeachment, and he was voted down. And it's really up to kind of Mitch McConnell to set the rules. How fast does this go? And also the fact that if you remember, like Ken does, I'm sure, you know, the Senate trial of Clinton. I mean, this is the most boring TV in history because the Senate has very little activity during it. They basically serve as a jury, and that means they're going to be very quiet and passive during whatever constitutes the trial based on articles of impeachment.
And has Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell committed to holding a trial?
That's what he said. And I think it's very interesting that he came so quickly out to say that, yes, if there are articles of impeachment, we will have no choice but to have a trial under the Constitution. He didn't have to say that. So I am kind of pleased because in the past, the Senate has very carefully and specifically defended its Senate prerogatives under the Constitution. Henry Cabot Lodge arguing against Woodrow Wilson about the League of Nations. Senator Wayne Morse after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution saying that there are going to be senators who rue the day that they gave up, congressional prerogative to the President of the United States to make foreign policy. So here's a moment in time where it seemed that Mitch McConnell, despite who's in the White House, perhaps defended that bit of Senate prerogative.
Ken, what would happen, do you think, if the articles of impeachment went from the House over to the Senate? And as Ted just mentioned in the Clinton case, there was a motion to dismiss the charges. Let's say a Republican senator makes that resolution, makes that motion, and it passes. And basically, there's no trial.
Well, yes, that's true. But the reason I don't think that will happen is because, unlike with Nixon and unlike with Clinton, one-third of the Senate, including Mitch McConnell, plus the President of the United States, are up for re-election in 2020. So what's fascinating about this particular case is that it's going to be going on as we're looking at the presidential primaries. And remember, Donald Trump has three, maybe insignificant, maybe not, challenges for the Republican nomination. And Mitch McConnell's up for it in a tough battle in Kentucky. So for all these arguments about what's going to happen if the Senate shuts down, as Ted probably correctly says, they're also trying to run for re-election. So a lot of things change in that. And I suspect that there will be tremendous pressure on some Republicans, like Susan Collins of Maine, like Tom Tillis of North Carolina, like Cory Gardner of Colorado, senators who may be in trouble, like Martha McSally of Arizona, Republicans who may be in trouble and some difficulty in 2020. I can't imagine they'll say we're going to vote not to go along with the trial after the House has voted to impeach. And so I suspect that in addition to a unanimous vote from the Democrats, you will have some Republicans who will go along with that, what the House said, at least in deciding to have the trial.
Well, Ken, let's say they go ahead and decide to have the trial. Are they still, the Republicans that you mentioned, are they still in a tenuous position in how they vote whether or not to convict the president?
Absolutely. I mean, when you think of what happened with Richard Nixon, it was different. There were such as, back then, I looked it up in the history books, there was something called, well, let me see. It was called a liberal Republican. They don't exist. They don't exist anymore. But back then, they had liberal Republicans in the Senate: Clifford Case and Ed Brooke and George Aiken and folks like that, and Charles Percy. And so there were Republicans who basically were not lockstep with the President of the United States. And in the Clinton impeachment trials, it was much more partisan. Only five Republicans in the House voted to impeach. Voted against impeaching Bill Clinton, and only five Democrats voted for it. So, but now, my goodness gracious, I mean, there's going to be tremendous pressure on these Republicans, in difficult situations, how to vote. And I suspect that that while the overwhelming numbers of both parties will stick with their respective parties, there will be enough crossing over to make it interesting. But does Donald Trump get convicted? Of course not. It's a Republican Senate, and you need two-thirds of the Senate, two-thirds of the Senate to convict. Even with the Republican Senate with Bill Clinton, the best they can get is like 50 votes to convict, or maybe there was a little more than 50 votes in one of the votes. But two-thirds, forget about it.
And Ted, as Ken was mentioning, those Republicans who might be at risk voting whether or not to convict the president from those articles of impeachment, the Democrats face a very similar situation. Think about all those Democrats. I think there are 35 or 40 of them in the House who are freshmen and got elected in districts that Trump carried in 2016. What kind of risk do they face?
Well, I think this is exactly why Nancy Pelosi was so hesitant about embracing an impeachment inquiry. As Ken said, something that's different from Nixon and Clinton is that this is an incumbent president. And so does this play into the narrative that, you know, Democrats are trying to get around the ballot box by impeaching the president of the United States? There is a mechanism in place for getting rid of corrupt officials who are up for election, and that is by casting a vote. And the second thing is that, is this going to absolutely, and I think, you know, Peter Welch kind of indicated this, is this going to suck up all of the oxygen for the next 13 months of the Democratic message, which should be about healthcare and it should be about climate change. It should be about pocketbook, bread and butter issues about jobs and income equity. Isn't that how you get back those swing voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and not by a 13-month-long impeachment inquiry?
Let's talk to Kristen, who is calling from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hey, thanks a lot. I think I'm in Lindenville now. I'm on 91 North, but whatever. Hey, yeah, a quick comment. As one of the 16 living moderates left in the country, apparently, the Democrats lost the last election by ignoring blue-collar workers in the Rust Belt whom they thought they could take their two-time Obama voters' votes for granted. They were wrong. Trump, everyone hates him, even the moderates, but we're going to vote for him again. You know why? Because all we hear about is impeachment. It's the jealous girlfriend syndrome. They're furious. They're in a rage. They're not going to do their homework. They're going to flunk out because all they're trying to do is make the new girlfriend look bad. I get it. They hate Trump. But guess what? He's knocking it out of the park, even with people who hate him like me. He's doing a great job because all they're doing is fighting amongst themselves, saying how terrible he is. Are they feeding the poor? Are they helping the sick? Are they helping the elderly? Have they set a number on immigrants coming in? Trump's job is not to do that. It's to enforce the law. If they want fewer or more, vote it in. Tell them the number. Oh, right now I'm hearing.
All right, Kristen. Kristen, we appreciate your phone call and your point of view very much. Ken, what about that? That there are a lot of people looking at this and saying, you know, the Democrats just they never got over the fact that Trump won in 2016, and they're going to get him one way or another.
I really appreciate Kristen's call because there are a lot of Republicans who are saying that. I'm not saying Kristen's a Republican, but I am saying that there are a lot of people who feel that this is just a bid by the Democrats to overturn the 2016 election. And as Ted said earlier, Nancy Pelosi was almost tying herself in knots trying to make this as nonpartisan, nonpartisan as possible. But here's the thing: when you go back to, let me go back to Richard Nixon, for example. Right after the October Saturday Night Massacre, where he fired Archibald Cox and Elliot Richardson and Bill Ruckelshaus and all that, and right after that happened, a majority of Americans, 53%, was against impeachment. Only 38% supported it. So it took a long time. It took a long time for the country to come around to feel that Richard Nixon, who had won 49 states in 1972, was deserving of impeachment. Right now, Donald Trump's numbers are much worse. If you asked the American people a month ago, I think many of them, if not most of them, agreed with Kristen that this is political, that this president, whatever you think of him, is not deserving of impeachment. But the latest numbers basically show that 40s, and the last poll I saw, I think it was a CBS News poll, 46% want Trump impeached and removed from office, 45% don't. So this doesn't mean an overwhelming majority of the country wants him out, but the country is definitely split on it, and I'm not convinced that Democrats had really any kind of a choice, especially in light of what happened, what's going on with Ukraine.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Rachel, who's calling from Montreal. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to express that I have been a lifelong Republican, and I even went walking door to door when I wasn't even eligible to vote. So since 16, I have been a diehard Republican. So this year, because I was so disenchanted with Trump's amorality, I changed my affiliation to independent. I applaud the Congress for doing their job, and I really want those who are putting their Republican affiliation before the Constitution to take a strong look into what is their core values. And that's my comment, and thank you so much for having taken it.
Okay, Rachel, thanks very much for your phone call. Ted, is there a scenario here where Donald Trump comes out the winner of this debate in that the House votes to impeach him, the articles of impeachment, the Senate votes to acquit him, and he can say, hey, folks, Mueller looked at me, impeachment looked at me, I'm not guilty.
And it happens the day before the election. Absolutely. What do we know about Donald Trump? He loves a good fight. He loves to portray himself as the victim, and he loves to win. And so, again, this is why so many in the Democratic leadership are so hesitant to set this up for Donald Trump. There is virtually no way that he's actually going to be convicted in a Republican majority Senate and removed from office. And so we have just set Trump up for a victory on the eve of the election. And you bet the conservative echo chamber of Trump, his proxies, Republican leadership, and the conservative media is going to be hammering this over and over and over. Mueller took 2 years. It failed. No collusion, no obstruction. This is simply Mueller part two.
Let's start off with Heath in Springfield. Hi, Heath. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I want to talk a little bit about – I turned on the radio just as Representative Welch was finishing up his talk. I jumped into it at the point where he was saying something, and it's been a little bit since then. He was saying something about the people of the country want to feel like their vote counts, and then you don't want the elites to go ahead and just do something else. But that's really exactly what he's doing. He's saying, well, 2016 didn't end the way we thought it should. Therefore, you didn't vote the way we want you to vote. And we're going to remove this big, bad orange man in an office, and we're going to put in someone else or, you know, make it easier for us in 2020. So he is not doing anything that the Constitution says that he should be doing. They have completely ignored legislative processes this session, because they've been so focused on impeachment. And even if you don't like Trump, I personally think as a person he is rather distasteful. He has kept his campaign promises, though. So, you know, there's the first politician to do that. But as a Congress, they should be working more on changing the laws that he is enforcing if they don't like him, and less about removing him because they think that he tweets too much.
All right, Heath, we certainly appreciate your point of view. Ken, there's this idea that if Congress focuses so much on impeachment, they're not going to focus on anything else, and a lot of people are going to be very disappointed by that.
Well, the reason I think that's a crock is because when was the last time Congress accomplished anything, Democrat or Republican? I mean, to blame this all on impeachment is crazy. What happened to the Supreme Court hearings for Merrick Garland? When President Obama nominated him, Mitch McConnell not only didn't allow a vote, he didn't even allow a hearing. So let's not blame impeachment on Donald Trump for the reason Congress is not doing much. And the fact is, when you have a Democratic House and you have Mitch McConnell leading the Senate, there's a lot of things that Democrats are passing in the House. They passed major gun control legislation early this year, including background checks and limiting magazines and things like that. It never got the light of day in the Senate. So let's not blame this all on impeachment.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Elizabeth in Orwell. Hi, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Thanks for taking my call. I'm thinking about the role of the media in all this. When you were talking about how the Democrats might lose by this process because of the focus being entirely on that versus healthcare and education and all the many, many issues that need to be addressed. That's where the role of the media, they're the mouthpiece that most people get their news either from TV, social media, whatever. I get it from the radio. I don't have either of those TV or social media outlets that I use. So, you know, this is where it's the responsibility of reporters to ask questions, direct things in the debates. on Twitter or these platforms for people to get discussions going and for reporters to not just focus on impeachment. Yes, it's important, but there's a whole big world of things going on that we also need to be informed about.
Elizabeth, thanks for your phone call very much. Ted, I remember talking to Congressman Welch back in July when he announced that he would be supporting impeachment and asked him the question, you know, are you putting a lot of House Democrats at risk by doing this and opening the door for Donald Trump? And he said, you know what, I can't think about it that way. I've got to look at the articles. I've got to look at the activities and I got to pursue it from that point of view.
You know, I think I once said to you, Bob, that in many ways, the Congress people who all this time have been calling for impeachment, it's really they who are on the side of the angels. It's people like me who have been saying, well, you need to take into account kind of craven political calculations about the effects of this on 2020. You know, the people who are in Congress, they took an oath of office, no less important than the oath of office when you become president of the United States. They took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution. They took an oath, and part of their role potentially in the Constitution is to impeach and remove corrupt officials from high offices. If you take an oath of office to do that, you're supposed to ignore that. So I really admire Congressman Welch saying, you know, look, I have, you know, political calculations like anybody else, but this is my constitutional responsibility.
Ken, you were talking about 1974 a couple of times, the Watergate case and Richard Nixon. Did we learn in that whole episode that the cover-up was as important or more important than the actual crime itself?
Well, that's the old cliche that the cover-up was worse than the crime, and there's truth to that because, I mean, as sloppy as the crime was, the breaking into the Democratic National Committee to get dirt on whatever, Lawrence O'Brien or Ed Muskie, you know, we got to stop that Ed Muskie. But, I mean, the fact is that one, I don't believe the president authorized the break-in, but I do know that he covered it up and blocked every subpoena and refused to give up the tapes until the end. So that ultimately did him in. Now, the difference, of course, is that, and I think this is a little bit in response to who called earlier? I think it was Rachel who talked about that the Republicans, you know, she's a former Republican, and Republicans should come to the plate. There is not a single Republican in the House who has called for impeachment or the president's resignation. There's not a single Republican who is every time a Republican now is asked about impeachment, they say, what about Joe Biden? What about corruption? It reminds me of, what about Hillary's emails? It's always about deflection, deflection, deflection. And there doesn't seem to be the kind of profiles and courage we may have seen with for example, with Nixon in 74. I think one of the fears that Democrats have always had about impeachment is that they go back to the Clinton impeachment, and they know that the Republicans pushed through impeachment of a popular president led by Newt Gingrich, and the Republicans actually lost seats in 1998 midterms because they overreached with impeachment. So they feel, well, if we do the same to Trump, we'll pay the price. But as Peter Welch says, and a lot of moderate centrist Democrats have also said that, and I think Ted was alluding to this as well, that adherence to the rule of law is far more important than getting reelected. Certainly Democrats are saying that more than Republicans.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Chris, who's calling from Tunbridge. Hey, Chris.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm an independent. I support Trump, and I'm all for us going to impeachment, because then in the Senate, we go to trial. And so I encourage Nancy Pelosi, Peter Welch, and these people to vote for impeachment. Let's get to trial. let's see the corruption. Because, come on, let's get real here. We know that influence has been sold in our politics for years, and it goes on both sides, Republicans and Democrats. However, under the Clinton machine, I think the corruption went to a whole new level. And so let's get to it. I guess that's my comment. Let's get to it. Let's get to trial. Let's get to discovery. You know, let's get to the brass tacks of this. So I'm all for the Senate, you know, going to trial. That's my comment.
Okay. Bob, can I jump in here? I mean,
sure,
I understand Chris's argument. I understand that you're absolutely right. Presidents sell influence. They buy and sell influence. I would even argue that the Clintons were known for that. But not in anybody's memory, including Richard Nixon's presidency, did any president go to a foreign leader, foreign leaders, because apparently China is now part of this, and ask for help dealing with a domestic political rival. I want dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russians. I want dirt on Joe Biden from the Ukrainians, because it'll help my reelection. We're talking about Adam Schiff being tried for treason. What president talks like that? I know Chris is going to enjoy this Senate trial, and yes, he's absolutely right. The president will not be removed from office. There's no two-thirds vote that's going to do that in the Senate. But my goodness, if what you're seeing does not outrage you about presidential misconduct, then I don't know what the bar is anymore.
And Ted, we got this message from Edna in Peru who wants to go back to that video of Donald Trump saying, hey, Russia, if you're listening, can you find those 30,000 emails for me? And Edna is writing us saying, what's the difference? Isn't that the same kind of thing?
Well, and, you know, frankly, I think the Mueller report just set that bar about a conspiracy way too high. And plus, not just that call of Donald Trump, but you know, the dozens of meetings between the top Trump campaign members and members of the Trump family and Russians. Absolutely. I think there was corruption and abuse of power and criminal intent there. I think Mueller kind of dropped the ball on crafting conspiracy as a tacit or, you know, contractual intent in a much too narrow way.
Ken, before we go, I wanted to talk to you about Bernie Sanders and the news this week when he had emergency surgery on Tuesday night to repair a blocked artery. His wife, Jane, says he'll rush up for a few days, coming back to Burlington this weekend, and then he'll go back on the campaign trail, and he will definitely be at the next Democratic debate on October 15th. What impact, if any, does Bernie's health situation have on the Democratic race?
I think it's major. I know that people have chest discomfort, and stents it's not an unusual thing to have that kind of procedure. It happens all the time. But when you're 78 years old and you're running for president, you'll be 83 years old at the end of your first term. That question is a legitimate question. And while by all accounts that the senator is doing fine, he's resting fine, he did pull away $1 million plus from Iowa advertising. He is failing in the polls. I think it hurts him, even if his health is not seriously affected.
And Ted, there was an article today in Politico that said, hey, it's not only Bernie Sanders with age, it's also Joe Biden. Joe Biden will turn 77 next month. Does this sort of rub off on him too?
Yeah, this just restarts the conversation within the Democratic Party about a new generation versus a group of people nearing 80 years old being the leaders. Is this really the fresh new face of the Democratic Party?
Do you think it causes any voters to say, is this the candidate we really want to have go up against Trump?
Well, let's see what happens on October 15th. Let's see how Bernie Sanders looks. If he has to stand behind a podium for 3 hours, you know, what does he look like? Does he stumble? Does he slur his words? I think that could be a turning point in the Sanders campaign.
We need that youngster, Elizabeth Warren.
That's right. Only 70.
Well, we'll certainly be following Bernie's health and also the entire impeachment process very closely in the next few weeks. Many thanks to our guests today, Ken Rudin and Ted Cohn. We really appreciate you being on the program and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you,
Bob. Thanks, guys.